The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond. The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With lightning speeds up to 1 gigabit, you can share, play and stream on all of your devices all at once.
At 9:26, award-winning actor and best-selling writer Kate Mulgrew has played some iconic television characters, including Red from Orange is the New Black to the very popular Captain Catherine Janeway on Star Trek Voyager. But it is a writing talent that brings her to this year's Galway International Arts Festival, where she'll appear in conversation at NUI Galway this Sunday at an event entitled How to Forget. It's also the title of her latest memoir. Kate Mulgrew, good morning and welcome to our programme.
Ryan, how are you?
It's really nice to talk to you.
You?
In real life.
Is this real life?
Well, it is.
I don't see you.
Is this just fantasy?
Let me ask you a question, Ryan, before we hurl ourselves into this interview. Do you have a grandmother by the name of Dot?
Well, it's interesting you should say that. I had a very close family relative by the name of Dot Tubridy, who passed away sadly a couple of years ago, but who, along with Courtney Kennedy Hill, we launched a lovely retrospective in Trim in County Meath a month ago to her memory and her connection with the Kennedy family, which I think is probably where you're going.
I met her either through Jean or Ethel several times.
Did you really?
And she was loved. She was beloved by them.
What a nice thing to say.
She was a great, great woman. I thought perhaps she was your grandmother.
Well, she was, as I say, a relative of ours, and who I would meet in the supermarket regularly, and I'd look at her hurtling down the aisles with a trolley, a cart as you'd say, and thinking, that woman she's got a lot, she's full of life. You know, she was one of those people who was just intrigued by
mischievous people.
Yes.
Alert eyes.
Yes.
But you have a Kennedy association. You've written about the Kennedys, John, right?
Yeah, I did a little bit of a book about his time in Ireland. I feel like I'm being interviewed here. This is all right. But because he did
it. No, I'm not. But we just have this association.
No, I appreciate
that. I think
that.
It's fascinating.
And because you were friendly with Jean Kennedy Smith.
Yes, she was my mother's best friend.
And she was ambassador, as you know, to this
she
country.
She was indeed. My mother came over often.
Did she?
Yes, she did. They were caught jumping off the boat into the Shannon River in their knickers together. I think they'd had some wine.
Well, you see, jumping off a boat in your knickers after too much wine, these are the kind of things people need to do because you have to live the life, otherwise it's gone.
You've got to live the life.
Don't you?
And I loved what you said earlier about grief and the tips for grief. Just doing things for people who are in grief. Don't ask. People don't want to answer questions, do you know?
That's right.
Just adding to the duress. But if you just nip in there and do it, that's the trick. Very good.
You don't need to create. I call it molehill productions, Kate. You know, people who take the molehill and go.
You're absolutely right. As if it's about them.
That's right. That's right.
It's not about them.
No.
Get in there. Take that garbage out. Mop those floors and don't let her blink an eye about it.
I hope everyone felt the same way about that comment from that mother as you do, because then a lot of grass is going to be cut this weekend, hopefully around the country.
I hope so.
You talked about your mother anyway, Kate. It's so nice to talk to you. And your mother and the Irish connections, is that where it comes from, your interest in Ireland? Because I know you spend a lot of time here.
Both sides. Very, very Irish on both sides. And it was my father who actually compelled me to come to Ireland. My first stop was Dingle, Ireland, when I was 18 years old. My father called me. I was in New York studying. And he said, you've got to get on a plane and come over. I've fallen in love with an Irish woman.
Brilliant.
Of course, he was well married to my mother at the time. So I had to jump on that plane, didn't I, Brian?
You sure did.
To see with my own eyes who it was who had felled my old man. And there she was, Kate Ash, standing behind the bar at Ash's Pub, Main Street, Dingle, a sheet of black hair down to her hips, flashing blue eyes and a swath of lipstick on her, red lipstick on her mouth, and my father just gazing at her. And I thought, well, I understand it now. I fell in love with Dingle. I fell in love with that peninsula. I went south to Kenmare, fell even more deeply in love with that part of the country. Although I must tell you, I find Galway very, very lovely. It's softer here, isn't it?
It's enchanting.
Connemara,
You're talking to a proper Connemara lover
you're
here.
You're a Clifton man, are you?
Yeah, Clifton. You've done your homework. Clifton, Roundstone, Belladangan, Carrow, all of that part of the country.
I was over there. Carrow, completely Irish-speaking. I was just
That's
out there the other day, but we took a walk in Clifton yesterday. I love Clifton.
It's good fun.
The sky. Aussie. Loop. Gorgeous.
Yeah, yeah, you have it in one. You'd be called Koch now. You know that in Irish.
Yes, I do know, and I resent that.
You resent it?
What does it mean?
Well, it just means, take it as a compliment. It's a lovely name.
All right, good. Thank you.
But if I could go back a little bit about you as a 12-year-old, because it's the poems that you were writing and thinking maybe this is the way forward, and then you read out a poem about World War One, and really that was where the fork in the road arrived in many ways.
In terms of my
future
career choice.
Yeah.
Well, that was my mother.
Yes.
Who said to me after I'd recited The White Cliffs of Dover by Alice Dewar Miller, World War One love story. I was 12. I did it for the nuns, and they were all in tears of joy that they could get out of their lives for 1 second. But I recited it. We got in the car, we drove home, and she was absolutely silent. Now, mind you, my mother was never silent. So something was up. Something dreadful was up. Mm. My heart was in my throat. Mm. And just before we went through the gate, she turned off the ignition and she turned to me and she said, "Kitty cat, you can either be a very mediocre poet or you can be a great actress. And I think you should go for that." And that was just the moment when the switch went off.
Yeah.
And she helped me every inch and step of the way.
She strikes me as being sort of, I don't know if bohemian is the right word, but certainly...
Original, Ryan.
At the real deal?
A complete and utter original. And all the attendant eccentricities thereof.
Yes. Yeah, okay.
But a gorgeous human being. I was mad about her from the time I could... from the time I was born.
Yeah. It just always puzzles me how somebody so full of life and curiosity and intellectual pursuit and everything that goes with it... Not ends up is the wrong word, but how does she fall in love with a man who appears to be quite aloof, certainly to his children, or a little more difficult?
Well, she was working as Jack Kennedy's, I put this in quotes, private secretary in Chicago at the time when he was running against Henry Cabot Lodge Jr.
Mm. What are we going to do with those quotes, Kate?
I think you just have to let them fly away.
Oh, dear, dear. Keep going.
And she had an apartment with Gene Kennedy.
Yes.
My father would stare at her at Mass. I believe they went to St. Pat's. She'd sit four pews ahead of him, and he'd stare at her Sunday after Sunday until finally he asked her to have a cup of coffee, and she said, "You must be joking. I don't date short men." Of course, her heart was elsewhere. So everybody went back to Boston and New York. Jack married Jackie Bouvier, as everybody knows. Gene married Steve Smith, as most people know. Effie Harris married Bobby Harris, and my mother was the only one left unmarried, painting her little watercolors in her garret apartment in Boston. And she picked up the phone 6 months after the day that she'd left Chicago. And my father answered, and she said, "It's Joan. If you're still interested, I'll marry you." And he was on the next plane.
Well, so, I mean, no more to add to that.
I mean, she just captured him.
Yes.
Now, my father was a very charismatic, extremely good-looking, witty, well-spoken man, and he was going to do well. But she, I believe, from his perspective at least, was the prize. And her resistance was understandable. She was an Easterner. Why would she go to Dubuque, Iowa?
Yeah.
But she did, and she had 8 children consecutively.
Very Irish scenario, yes.
Very Irish. Well, you have to slash that with Catholic.
Of course you do. Of course you do.
Yeah.
And when you came to the west of Ireland on beautiful Lough Carb to write a novel, and that changed and morphed into the... It feels like just reading around and about you, and it seems like you had an epiphany of some sorts, almost a visitation.
About this book?
Just in the sense that you seem to be on the road to write fiction and something happened.
I'd say it's the tap, tap, tap.
The tap, 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 exactly.
Of the psychic ice pick.
What is that?
Of the subconscious psychic ice pick. It's the thing that won't leave you alone and you keep running away from it. Mm-hmm. So every day I'd start some paragraph about some, interesting thing I thought was interesting about my father that I was going to novelize. And I'd come back to my father the day he was told he had just a few weeks to live. And the night that we spent after that death sentence was directed at him. And I every day came back to it for, I'd say, a good 2 weeks. And finally, in front of the fire, with tears streaming down my cheeks and a whiskey, I said, "All right, Dad, I guess we have a reckoning, so I'm going to write about that night. You were told you had a couple of weeks to live. We went home. I poured the vodka out, As the night progressed, we consumed the entire bottle of vodka in front of a crackling fire, and I asked you all the questions that had remained in abeyance all those years, and you answered them. And that was the first part that issued from my subconscious. And in tandem with it, of course, was the story of how he loved my mother.
Yes.
He wanted to talk about that night with me. And that obviously became part two of the book.
Why do we as human beings and people like your dad and daughters like you leave it till either too late to have a frank conversation like that or don't bother at all? Are we afraid?
Yeah, we're afraid of them. Yeah. I was afraid of him.
And the truth?
I'm not afraid of the truth. No, that doesn't exist in
so
my family.
So what were you afraid of?
Him.
Because of what? What was he going to?
He was a tough guy.
Yeah.
And we were at battle with one another for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, if you know, we were going to get psychological about it, over my mother. Now, my mother had sort of chosen me. She championed me. My father resisted that and resented that. And certainly when I became even slightly successful and she was coming to me all the time, he really began to resent that. So I think that this impasse between my father and myself needed to be bridged. I loved him. I know that he loved me, but it was a bridge too far until that night. And in that, in front of that fire that night, when the jig was up, he just looked at me and let me have it. All the things I'd always wanted to know. Not did he love me, but why he'd never seen me act in, what was it, when he died, 35 years.
He saw you perform twice in your 30-year career.
Twice, and never in totality. He left it intermission, Titus Andronicus, Shakespeare in the Park.
What did
New
you
York.
Overhear him say?
I overheard from the dressing rooms were in the tunnels in the park. I heard this voice, "When the hell is halftime?" I thought, oh my God, that's my father. I'm sure she got him out of there. And the other time was, yes, Richard Burton.
In Ireland.
Yeah, in Love Spell. That was in Dubuque at a fundraiser.
In Dubuque, excuse me.
Yeah,
she
and
made
he just
it
turned
Ireland,
to me and
yeah.
he said, "I don't understand a bloody word." Set up there.
Okay, and why did he not go and see you or support you? You say that, you said, there's a quote that I was intrigued by. You said he was a master at reducing his children.
Well, he was a master at reducing me, certainly, his daughters. I think from his point of view, it would have been to keep us in our place. But from mine, it was a shattering refusal to acknowledge me as someone who was going to become independent of him, and who was not only ready and willing to do so, but very happy to do so. I think that he was born in a time when reckoning with your oldest daughter, who was I was an outspoken, I was a passionate kid, I could be a brassy kid, I could be a cheeky kid.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't allowed, it wasn't encouraged, it wasn't admonished in the proper way. You just said, stop it. So this wall went up between us. And I think that's why he just... He wasn't going to encourage it. He wasn't going to support it. He wasn't going to champion it. And even though he laughed and he said, "I think it's fine what you're doing, Hollywood," even the sobriquet indicates, doesn't it, a sort of disparagement.
He called you Hollywood, did he?
Hollywood, yeah. In the beginning. You know, my nickname from my father was Kitten, which I adored.
Of course you did.
I adored it, you know, and I remember that the first time sort of hitting my right ear when I was 3 or 4. Yes, I'm Kitten. That's great. And that transformed itself into Big Shot, Hollywood, whatever it was, you know. Kitten and Sugar sort of took a back seat to Hollywood as the years went on.
Do you think he didn't like you?
I think he did like me. And that concerned him as well. Because then it makes it very difficult to explain why you've not watched your daughter's talent. You have to make it becomes very problematic to explain why you have behaved the way you've behaved when you like the girl so as much as I know he did.
That's why I wanted to ask you. I want to go back to the fire side and the bottle of vodka.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get an answer to the question of how the man who adored his daughter Kitty Cat became the grumpy misanthrope who dismissed her as Hollywood?
Yes, he said. Well, we were talking about death and how he felt about dying. He said, I don't fear it, but I don't welcome it either. And he said, and regarding your mother, and he nodded curtly because she was in the other room turning to stone with Alzheimer's disease. He said, you know, I didn't come up to the plate. I'm afraid I let your mother down. I let myself down. I became average with the griefs that beset me with the deaths of your two sisters. And then this thing with your mother, which he never named, Ryan.
What is the thing?
He never named Alzheimer's.
Really?
And when I had the neurologist come out to tell him face to face, he still resisted it. Well, thank you, pal. You've come a long way for nothing. I got everybody telling me stuff that I don't need to hear. And he never acknowledged it. Never. Never.
Why, Kate?
I think she was it. She was it. I mean, she was the reason. His raison d'etre. And there was some, you can call it poetic, you can call it mystical, you can call it Greek reason. Why, if he named the thing that was turning her, calcifying my mother, I think then he would obviously have died himself far sooner than he did. As it was, I think he did not dance out the doors of life. Neither did he drag his heels. She was gone. She was the light. She gave him what for, of course, but she was the elusive light of his life. She was the one he loved. The rest of us came as a result of that love. He was always scratching after her heart.
Yeah. I can see why you wrote the way you talk, the way you write, the way you remember.
I remember it vividly.
You really do. And you paint that picture.
Yeah.
You describe a chapter, an element in it. I'm going back to your first memoir, if you don't mind, for a moment.
Born with Teeth.
Born with Teeth, which was a bestseller. And anyone listening this morning will know why your books are bestsellers, because you tell a universal story, I think, in your family. And you actually confront a lot of beasts that families don't really want to. You've lifted the rug, if you like. And including in your own. And I don't want to get into too much detail. I certainly don't want to upset you, but just in terms of you being pregnant with your first child, your daughter, and you were working at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Making
my first job.
Your first job in a new soap called
Ryan's Hope,
playing Mary Ryan, an Irish-American family run a bar. And you find you're pregnant. I don't know how much you want to talk about that. But I do want to ask you about giving your child up.
Mm-hmm.
And where you were at in your head, you're only a youngster, essentially.
Where was I at in my head?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Had
nothing to do with my head.
Well, tell me about it.
Well, you mean where was I at in my soul?
Yeah, even better.
Because this is a life and death decision,
sure,
isn't it? And I was 20 years old, and I was becoming successful very quickly. I went home to my parents. My father didn't, of course, want to even acknowledge this, but I said to my mother, I need your help. I'm going to need your help because I'm going to have this baby. And if you can look after the baby at the beginning, then I can, with my money, we can support her and we can blah, blah, blah. And my mother looked me in the eye and she said, well, look, kitten, that's impossible. I mean, Tessie just died last year. That's my sister, Tess. And Maggie died. And I can't do it. I can't help you. So you do what's right. You'll do what's right. So I went to my boss, the incomparable Claire Labine, who's no longer with us, and I said, Claire, I'm pregnant and I have to resign. And she said, well, with your permission, I'd like to write this into the story. And that's how it came to be true that Mary Ryan actually had a baby in front of 6 million people. That was me. And by the time the baby came, of course, it was absolutely hopeless. So I gave the baby up for adoption, immediately regretted it, and spent the next 20 years pursuing her and found her.
You took 3 days off the soap to have the baby.
I did. I get a full three. I think it was 2.5.
Two and a half.
The baby, took the next day off, came back in.
Amazing.
They put a little baby in my arms. A little stunt baby in my arms, and I had a 10-minute monologue.
Holy smoke.
About how that baby and I were going to live a wonderful, fruitful life.
You went back to the Catholic charity to get the baby back. They wouldn't help you. And you went on with your life. You endeavoured to. And you had two sons. And mm-hmm. But you spent, as you said a minute ago, 20 years looking for that
I
child.
I never stopped looking for
you. You never stopped looking. No. I can understand entirely why. And you had private investigators. And
I had it all.
But it was actually a gala attended by the nun who facilitated the adoption.
Sister Uma. I'll never forget it. Yeah. And I cornered her in the back room. Well, I've been on my knees to her several times over the years. And I said, I'm going to give you about 48 hours to let me know where my daughter is and that she is well and to give me a photograph. Or I'm going to go to the New York Times with this story.
Good on you.
And she said, go home. I will send papers to you and your daughter at the same time. And a connection will probably be made as a result of that. I said, probably. She said, I can't promise that your daughter will sign the papers. So the next thing, I was working on a series called Star Trek Voyager. It was 5 o'clock in the morning and the phone rang.
Yes.
And a woman said, this is Susan Collins from Soundex Social Services. Are you sitting down?
Mm-hmm.
And standing rigidly, I said, of course I am. She said, is your name Catherine Kiernan Mulgrew? Yes. Did you or did you not give birth to a baby girl on such and such a date, such and such a time in New York City? I did. Well, Miss Mulgrew, I believe we have a match. Then I sat down. Yeah.
The match called you?
The match called me immediately with a high, sweet voice. You know, mine is so sort of booming, deep, high, sweet, angelic voice, saying she thought that perhaps she was my biological daughter. And of course I had to resist because the PA's knocking on the door every now 3 seconds. Kate, you're wanted on the soundstage. Kate, it's time to shoot. Kate. I thought I was going to go mad. I opened the door, covered the phone, and said to the PA, if you knock one more time, I will kill you. Leave me alone.
Yes.
Back to her. I said, I'm so sorry to say this to you. I'm at work. The story of my life, the story of why you're where you are and I'm where I am. Mm-hmm. Work. Mm. I have to go, but I'm coming. May I come this weekend? And she said, I'll have to check with my mother. And evidently it was all right with her mother. I got on a plane and I met her in the lobby of the St. Charles Hotel in Boston. And my first words to the daughter I had not seen in 20 years, had never seen because they took her out of my arms immediately after birth. My first words to my daughter were, I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to help me get up. Life.
Life.
Life, yeah.
Did you see the daughter you dreamt of, or did you see something?
It was me swinging across Harvard Yard through the door. It was me with perhaps the beautiful inky blackness of her father's hair. But me, my face. Me. Yeah.
Well, I don't do stuck for words, but I kind of a little bit, but only because it's very beautiful but poignant, you know, like so many stories in life.
It's very hard.
It is hard.
And a lot of people would say, well, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? That's what I get all the time. I especially get that from feminists.
You,
yeah.
Oh, do you listen to that? Do you care about that?
I care because it was so huge. It shaped my whole life.
Yeah.
Every movement thereafter, every decision. I believe who I am in every way. It was defined by that decision in that moment. And so when women in particular confront me, want to know why I didn't take an alternative path that perhaps would have been better for both of us, I just have to say, how do you know, how could you possibly guess that it would have been better for both of us?
But isn't that with anything in life, Kate, in terms of personal stories, the only person who knows about a personal story, that's right. Why they're called that, is the person at the heart of it, and no one else can judge it.
And I can tell you this, and I think that this is the greatest gift of my life. If there is one to be plucked from the mass of it, it would be, there was absolutely no hesitation. I knew exactly that I was going to have that baby. Win, lose, or draw. The baby would have life. There was no equivocation at all.
You know, we're running out of time, and we haven't mentioned Star Trek Voyager. We haven't mentioned Orange.
Well, we have to mention the book,
Black,
because that's what I'm here
doing.
But
this book is going to fly off the shelves as a direct result of our conversation this morning, because you tell your story so well, and How to Forget a Daughter's Memoirs part.
Well, I hope people will come and attend the event on Sunday night.
It's going to be, you're in conversation with Ethna Verling on Sunday at 6 p.m.
My great friend Ethna Verling. She's
Wonderful. Absolutely
fabulous
and
woman.
It's at NUI Galway's Bailey Hall. It's part of the Galway International Arts Festival, which runs until the 28th of July. So it's GIAF.ie. Can I give you a sense of what people are saying about you on our listeners, if you don't mind?
Please.
Let's see. Interview with Kate Mulgrew is the most resonant, interesting, most riveting interview I've heard in a very long time, says Susan. Another, what a thoroughly engaging and intelligent lady, and what a voice, such a wonderful lilt. Another wonderful interview, says Vivian, with Kate Mulgrew. And what a fascinating, eloquent, poetic, literate, educated, honest and enchanting woman Kate is. I could listen to her speak for hours. That's from James.
James. Where are you, James?
Yeah, where art thou, James? Get to Galway. Completely enraptured with this morning's interview. Incredibly told, says Ali. Her storytelling is second to none. I love listening to Kate this morning. Wonderful interview. Wonderful, wonderful, Kate. I've been hanging on every word, says Helen. A non-judgmental, searingly accurate analysis of some fathers from a certain time not coming to terms with their eldest daughters. Brilliant. I love it, Kate, and welcome home. Can you believe the twists and turns, says Owen, of life 2 days ago? Once again, I am reminded of the loss of my sister whilst attending to her grave. And I tune into the radio this morning and I hear her heroine, Kate Mulgrew, is going to be on your show. And when she was being bullied at school, she could not sleep and spent hours watching and rewatching Voyager. I didn't know how much she was suffering because I was selfishly caught up in my world, but I know that she got great comfort from this character. It's 15 years since her dream came through, and she met Kate on the set of the programme through the kind intercession of Bob Picardo, who keeps in contact with my brother, a priest. So poor Marianne died suddenly, aged 33, just 2 years ago, her sister. And it's still a hard loss, but these memories keep her alive. So please thank Kate on her and our behalf.
What a beautiful sentiment. Thank you, Ryan, for sharing that.
Isn't that something?
My God, yeah.
Yeah, that is something.
33, how did she die?
It doesn't say. She died suddenly, sadly, but
she was
obviously a great fan of you and what you did on Star Trek.
Well, that's deeply gratifying, really, with lovely comments.
Let's do this again sometime, Kate, face-to-face.
Let's do it face-to-face.
Yeah,
I'd love to meet you, Ryan.
Same here. I really enjoyed your company this morning, I must say.
I have a feeling that our chat could evolve into something really deep and splendid.
Well, you know what? There's so many good bars around. You know, we'd have to take
it
to the next step and do some research in a couple of bars.
You needn't say another word now,
yeah,
Ryan.
Okay. Well, let's make it so, as somebody might have said once upon a time, but I'd love to do that. Kate, thank you for your honesty, your candor, and for sharing your story through your memoir with us this morning. It's been very memorable indeed. I really enjoyed our conversation today.
I thank you, Ryan. Me too.
Enjoy Galway, and as the listener said there a few minutes ago, welcome home.
Will do. Thank you very much.
Mind yourself. Thank you, Kate.
Bye-bye.
That's Kate Mulgrew joining us this morning. Her book, How to Forget, A Daughter's Memoir is as beautiful and poetic as she is to talk to. So, and universal is the word I'd use. It's the story that doesn't belong to Idaho or New York or Boston, but actually could sit comfortably in Longford and Roscommon or Cork or Galway or Dublin. All right, and the text response has been phenomenal, to say the least, but we do have to take a break, so we'll be back after this.